Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. You're running out of time, folks. And don't think that some president's going to come along and actually save you, because the way the system is controlled today, we'll never have that president. I mean, I went through a very specific series of what a constitutional president could do and how he could literally change the direction of this nation at the risk of actually and likely being assassinated. So all things being equal, we'll cover that on Feedback Friday. But today we're going to jump right back into Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention. And we're covering, so the last few topics that we're really covering is property, land property, that type of stuff. And we've noticed already that the reason why the focus of slavery, the property of people, was such a big issue. I mean, they talked a lot about it. You can't tell me that they weren't trying to address this issue and resolve it. Anybody that just says they were just a bunch of racists is so disingenuous. I mean, anybody that does that is somebody that blindly embraces a big lie. Because what was happening in this nation was a very slow evolutionary process that does not normally occur. And I mean this, folks. How long has slavery been around? 5,000 years plus, right? And so slavery has been institutionalized in every society. It was this society that actually on its own, it wasn't because some other nation came upon us. No other nation could. The only way we fell is by corruption from within, from outside influences. But, and we'll get into that. We get into that all the time, but I don't want to get into it today. The fact of the matter is that this nation on its own accord addressed the elephant in the room. And why did they do this? Not because they bought into the big lies of the progressives and communism and so forth. It's not because they were manipulated. It was because at that point in time, they were an enlightened society. And we actually started moving down this path of becoming I don't want to say overly focused, but had everything been followed in the Constitution, slavery would have been eradicated long before the Civil War. We go through this. The Constitution basically ended up or provided the end of slavery on a silver platter. So as we look at this dialogue going back and forth, what I'm trying to do is I want to, you know, break out, you know, how important private property was. Now, I want you to think about this, because they recognized that the private individual property was sacred, even though there was this one form of property that was unacceptable. But they had to accept it because it was unreleasable by the southern states. In other words, the three southern states said, you know, we're leaving the Union. So they made this compromise. And so when we look at how your property today is viewed as assets and resources by government, that is not proper. That is not proper at all. Now, it's one thing for them to have taxation, but this is where it all boils down. This is where, you know, I get engaged at very local levels with politicians and local teams, local grassroots people working with those politicians to help them understand what we have to do in getting government back into the framework of the Constitution. Bottom line, as I said this week with the county commissioners, a county commissioner in Wyoming, was that we have to actually start challenging everything the government is doing. It's basically, we have enumerated governments, but the way government acts and is operating, they believe they're empowered to do anything and everything. And that is a lie. We have enumerated constitutions. We do not have general constitutions. And as I was telling this, you know, you could tell this county commissioner was getting it. He completely agreed. And he goes, well, what do we need to do? And this is why we're talking about what it's going to take to set up these committees. Now, if I call these things committees of safety, well, that would actually give it the likeness. But here's the thing. Can a county commissioner, and I'm giving this to the NLA, can we, the people, form a committee of safety? No, because we are no longer under the British rule. We are no longer a magistrate form of government. We have a representative government. We're Republican, which means that the people that have the authority to actually form is your county commissioners. And it kind of came to me after talking, and we're going to get into this tomorrow. Let me get into this tomorrow. Let's dive into Mr. Rufus King, and I'm not speaking of Rufus, the pop artist of, what, the 70s? Anyway, Mr. King is, you know, again, we're talking about this long thread of property, and we're also, this is the 26th of July. Mr. King observed that there might be great danger in requiring landed property as a qualification, since it would exclude the moneyed interest whose aids may be essential in particular emergencies for the public safety. Mr. Dickinson was against any recital of qualifications in the Constitution. It was impossible to make a complete one, and a partial one would be implications tie up the hands of the legislature from supplying the omissions. The best defense lay in the freeholders who were to elect the legislature. Now, just keep in mind here, who are these freeholders? These freeholders are freemen who actually own land and have the money to be able to pay the poll taxes, because that happened to be a way government was funded. Whilst this source would remain pure, the public interest would be safe. If it ever would be corrupt, no little expedience would repel the danger. He doubted the policy of interweaving into a Republican Constitution a veneration for wealth. He had always understood that a veneration for poverty and virtue were the objects of Republican encouragement. It seemed improper that any man of merit should be subjected to disabilities in a republic where merit was understood to form the great title of public trust, honor, and rewards. And so as we move to the next person up, Mr. Gary of Massachusetts basically stands up and says, if property be one object of government, provisions for securing it cannot be improper. Then Mr. Madison steps up and says, Mr. Madison moved to strike, and again, he's he's speaking of himself, I move to strike out the word landed before the word qualifications. If the proposition should be agreed to, he wished the committee to be at liberty to report the best criterion could be devised. Landed possessions were no certain evidence of real wealth. As a matter of fact, how many times do you see people in your own community that have lots of land, but they're money poor, they're money strapped? Farmers are that way all the time. And so it's very common to have people that are land rich, but money poor. Anyway, Madison goes on and says, many enjoyed them to a great extent who were more in debt than they were worth. The unjust laws of the states had proceeded more from this class of men than others. It had often happened that men who acquired land property on credit got into the legislatures with a view of promoting an unjust protection of their creditors. Now, this is the important part. In the next place, if a small quantity of land should be made the standard, it would be no security. If a large one, it would exclude the proper representative of those classes of citizens who were not landholders. It was politic as well as just that the interests and rights of every class should be duly represented and understood in the public councils. It was a provision everywhere were established that the country should be divided into districts and representatives taken from each in order that the legislative assembly might be equal, actually says, equally understand and sympathize with the rights of the people in every part of the community. It was not less proper that every class of citizens should have an opportunity of making their rights be felt and understood in the public councils. The three principal classes, and so this, let me stop right here. I said this before, and I really believe that this is the spirit and the heart of this Constitution, because I don't believe everybody should be able to vote in on every issue. But I do believe, as Madison is pointing out, that we all have a right to basically vote for our representatives at the county, our representatives at the state, and our representatives at the federal level. Those are the representatives of the people. And creating these qualifications for representation, I think, is a big mistake. I think that we need to have parameters or qualifiers for people who were involved in other things, such as your governor or such as the president, such as all of these other things. Is the president there to represent all people? No, he's there to actually represent the Constitution. And I believe that this is where we actually have the ability to start qualifying, or I should say differentiating, between the average person. If you own property, then you should be able to vote on the initiatives or taxes that are going to be placed upon your property. People that do not own property should not be able to vote in that property tax initiative. It's almost like giving everybody the right to vote in all the corporate affairs that they own no stock to. When we look at how this the market has properly operated, you must be, you know, a holder. You must be a shareholder in that company before you can vote in the governance of that company. And I think it's the same thing when it comes to property taxes, the governance of property tax. You have to be a property holder. How is it that we've allowed this to go sideways into everybody has say over everything? That is the form of democracy, not representative. And those people who have stake in property should be the only ones that are voting in representing what is to be done with property. I think we would have a much better, and we would not be able to actually start going down this path of communism had we not implemented democracy. Anyway, Madison has a lot more to say, and this is what he says. The three principal classes into which our citizens were divisible were the landed, the commercial, and the manufacturing. The second and third class bear as much a small proportion to the first. The proportion, however, will daily increase. We see in the populous countries in Europe now what we shall be hereafter. These classes understand much less of others' interests and affairs than men of some class inhabiting different districts. It is particularly requisite, therefore, the interest of one or two of them should not be left entirely to the care or the impartiality of the third. This must be the case if landed qualification should be required, few if the mercantile, and scarcely if the manufacturing class, choosing whilst they continue in business to turn any part of their stock into landed property. For these reasons, he wished if it were possible that some other criterion than the mere possession of land should be devised. Madison concurred with Mr. Governor Morris in thinking that qualifications in the electors would be much more effectual than in the elected. The former discriminate between real and ostensible property in the latter, but he was aware of the difficulty forming any uniform standard that would suit the different circumstances and opinions prevailing the different states. Now, you know, one of the things I noticed without having Paul here, because Paul would say, hey, you got to explain this or not. But when he talks about the electors, this is a capital E elector. Now, we're talking about the qualifications as a elector for the Electoral College, and it's a little e for the elected. Anyway, Mr. Governor Morris seconded the motion on the question for striking out landed. So remember, Madison, when he started this off, he moved to strike out landed. And so on the question of striking out landed, New Hampshire said yes, Massachusetts said yes, Connecticut said yes, New Jersey said yes, Pennsylvania said yes, Delaware said yes, Maryland said no, Virginia said yes, North Carolina said yes, South Carolina said yes, and Georgia said yes. And notice they're not even including New York anymore, because New York is that does not have quorum for them to actually, there's nobody there. So, in other words, it was practically unanimous to move away from landed, a person that had to have land, property and land. On the question on the first part of Colonel Mason's proposition as to qualification of property and citizenship as so amended, New Hampshire said yes, Massachusetts yes, Connecticut no. And New Jersey said yes, Pennsylvania said no, Delaware said no, Maryland said yes, Virginia said yes, North Carolina said yes, South Carolina said yes, and Georgia said yes. So basically 3-8. The second part for disqualifying debtors and persons have unsettled accounts being under consideration. Mr. Carroll moved to strike out having unsettled accounts. Now, I want you to understand this. They started off basically making it so that this was an elitist aristocracy almost, because anybody that had debt, anybody that had unsettled accounts, you know, wow, they were making it so that you had to be a very solvent person to be involved in voting and government and so forth. So Mr. Gorham seconded the motion in striking out having unsettled accounts, observing that it would put the commercial and manufacturing part of the people on a worse footing than others, as they would be most likely to have dealings with the public. If these words should be struck out and the remaining words concerning debtors retained, it will be the interest of the latter class to keep their accounts unsettled as long as possible. Mr. Wilson was for striking them out. They put too much power in the hands of the auditors, who might combine with rivals in delaying settlements in order to prolong the disqualifications of particular men. We would consider that we were providing a constitution for future generations and not merely the peculiar circumstances of the moment. The time has been and will be again when the public safety may depend on the voluntary aids of the individuals, which will necessarily open accounts, and the public, in which accounts will be characteristic of patriotism, besides a partial enumeration of cases, will disable the legislature from disqualifying odious and dangerous character. Mr. Langdon was for striking out the whole clause for the reasons given by Mr. Wilson. So many exclusions, he thought, too, would render the system unacceptable to the people. Mr. Gary, if the arguments used today were to prevail, we might have a legislature composed of public debtors, prisoners or pensioners, placemen and contractors. He thought that the proposed qualifications would be pleasing to the people if they will be considered as security against unnecessary or undue burdens being imposed on them. He moved to add pensioners to the disqualified character, which was negatived. And so the whole point of all of this in trying to, go through this was just to show you that they were making it more and more possible that everybody would basically be able to have an opportunity in voting for their representation. Remember, this was the one thing that they had that they were driving in here was literally that concept of being able to, who was going to be able to vote in the system, who was going to be able to actually participate in, the voting and so forth. Now, didn't mean that there still wasn't a requirement for a poll tax. You still had to pay a poll tax. Now, the interesting thing, we're going to kind of skip over this, but it's worth noting that in August 6th, 1787, this is when we really start seeing the United States Constitution, or the Constitution for the United States, actually start taking form into the seven articles as they start condensing all of these massive articles down into these articles with sections and so forth. And this is, again, August 6th. And so moving all the way down to the next topic, there was this one little note that I've got to point out. This is on electors. Now, let me see, who was this saying this? Okay, Mr. Governor Morris said and moved to strike out the last member of the section beginning with the words, quote, qualifications of electors, close quote, in order that some other provision might be substituted which would restrain the right of suffrage from freeholders. So again, it was basically trying to guarantee the suffrage of the very particular or specific body of I'm going to call them shareholders, stakeholders, whatever you want to call them, the people in these different classes. Because remember, the Senate ends up becoming a body of representation, not for the people, but for the state legislatures. That's where their suffrage was to be recognized. See, as they started moving forward, they really started breaking down these classes of, who had representation. And it really came down to all of those people who had the ability to pay for their poll tax, regardless of however the state wanted to do the qualifications. They wanted to make sure that the Constitution allowed anybody and everybody who could pay their poll tax to be able to vote for representation. Now, the state legislatures, they appointed their senators. They didn't even have to go into an election. They held their own, basically, private election. Moving down a little further, Mr. Ellsworth makes this comment. And Mr. Ellsworth thought the qualifications of the electors stood on the most proper footing. The right of suffrage was a tender point and strongly guarded by most of the state constitutions. The people will not readily subscribe to the national constitution if it should subject them to be franchised. The states are best judges of the circumstances and temper of their own people. So, in other words, Mr. Ellsworth, and I have to point out, Mr. Ellsworth being a future, he was actually becoming a anti-federalist. He wanted to, and he was throwing this out here. He wanted to kind of keep the people, from being able to have all those controls in the federal government and the Constitution laying it out. He wanted to leave it to the states. Now, remember, the states were the bad actors. The states were the ones that were causing all of the problems, the state legislatures and these cabals in these states. So anyway, we'll be right back going into property and representation, that dialogue right after this. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so as we get back to the notes on the Constitutional Convention, property representation. Now, this actually kind of ties everything together here. In other words, they actually start, you know, pointing out how representation was to be done and how they were looking at representation. And again, it really came back down to, and they come right back around to slavery. Mr. Dickinson of Delaware had a different idea on the tendency of vesting the right of suffrage in the freeholders of the country. He considered them as the best guardians of liberty, and the restriction of the rights to them as a necessary defense against the dangerous influences of those multitudes without property and without principle with which our country, like all others, while in time abound as to the unpopularity of the innovation, it was his opinion chimerical. In other words, changing form. The great mass of our citizens is composed at this time of freeholders and will be pleased with it. Mr. Ellsworth, future anti-federalist, came up and said, "How shall the freeholders be defined? Ought not every man who pays a tax to vote on the representative who is to levy and dispose of his money? Shall the wealthy merchants and manufacturers who will bear a full share of the public burdens be not allowed a voice in the imposition of them? Taxation and representation ought to go together." And that's exactly what they ended up doing. This is why I point out that the reason why territories were being rushed into statehood is so that the federal government could start imposing taxes upon them. Mr. Governor Morris of Pennsylvania stated, or he had long learned not to be the dupe of words. The sound of aristocracy, therefore, had no effect on him. It was the thing, not the name, to which he opposed. And one of his principal objections to the Constitution, as it is now before us, is that it threatens this country with an aristocracy. The aristocracy will grow out of the House of Representatives, give the votes to the people who have no property, and they will sell them to the rich who will be able to buy them. We actually see this today, where we see that the voters and the homeless voters who don't have the ability and won't go to the polls to vote, they've been given these absentee ballots so that those ballots can be harvested by people that come along and give them booze or what have you, and or whatever services they claim. Anyway, we should not, this is back to what Mr. Governor Morris is saying, we should not confine our attention to the present moment. The time is not distant when this country will abound with mechanics and manufacturers who will receive their bread from their employers. Will such men be the secure, faithful guardians of liberty? Will they be the impregnable barriers against aristocracy? He was as little duped by the association of the words taxation and representation. The man who does not give his vote freely is not represented. The man who dictates the vote, children do not vote. Why? Because, I got to highlight. Children do not vote. Why? Because they want prudence, because they have no will of their own. The ignorant and the dependent can be as little trusted as the public interest. He cannot conceive the difficulty of defining freeholders to be inseparable. Still less that the restriction could be unpopular. 9 out of 10 people are at present freeholders, and these will certainly be pleased with it, as to the merchants and etc. They have wealth, they have value, and the right they can acquire it if they don't deserve it. Anyway, Colonel Mason then starts talking about property and land. We all feel too strongly, this is Colonel Mason, we all feel too strongly the remains of antient prejudices and view things too much through the British medium. A freehold is the qualification in England, and hence it is imagined to be only the proper one. The true idea, in his opinion, was that every man having evidence of attachments to and permanent common interest with society ought to share in its rights and privileges. Was this qualification restrained to freeholders? Does no other kind of property but land evidence a common interest in the proprietor? Does nothing besides property mark a permanent attachment? Ought the merchant, the moneyed man, the parent of a number of children, whose fortunes are to be pursued in his own country, to be viewed as suspicious character and unworthy to be trusted with the common rights of their fellow men or their fellow citizens? Mr. Madison then pipes up, "The right of suffrage is certainly one of the fundamental articles of a republican government and ought not to be left to be regulated by the legislature. A gradual abridgment of this right has been the mode in which aristocracies have built on the ruins of popular forms. Whether the constitutional qualification ought to be a freehold would, with him, depend upon the probable reception such a change would meet in the states where the right was now exercised by every description of people. In several of the states, a freehold was now the qualification. Viewing the subject on its merits alone, freeholders of the country would be the safest depositories of republican liberty. In future times, a great majority of people will not only be without landed, but any sort of property. These will either combine under the influence of their own common situation, in which case the right of property and the public liberty will not be secure in their hands, or which is more probable, they will become the tools of opulence and ambition, in which case there will be equal danger on another side. The example of England has misconceived by Colonel Mason a very small proportion of the representatives are there chosen by freeholders. The greatest part are those chosen by the cities and boroughs, of many of which the qualification of suffrage is as low as it is in the United States, and it was in the boroughs and cities rather than the counties that bribery most prevailed, and the influence of the crown on elections was dangerously exerted." In other words, you kind of look at how the crown would spend money in the boroughs and the cities where the less affluent people would live. The workers and those types of people, the people usually out in the landed areas and so forth, you know, were people that were more established. So it's interesting how they, the crown, was able and knew exactly where to go, because that's where they collected. People started, you know, I don't want to say communes, but people who were renters and were, you know, dependent on, you know, paycheck to paycheck, they were far more apt to surrender their suffrage and or vote the way they're being told, so that they can maintain it's that dependency on that neck check. And so when we look at America today, how many people today are receiving money from government? Here's the question. If you're receiving money from government, then should you have a right to vote on anything but your representation? This is why, and I want to explain why I don't see the danger in representation, because when we look at the powers we give our representatives, they don't have the ability to, and they shouldn't have the ability, and constitutionally, it's not there for them to be able to use the public purse to be able to pay these people. They shouldn't even be able to make that, you know, that cycle where they can actually do these handouts. That power doesn't exist in our Constitution, folks. It is the elected that have assumed that. And I'm going to be the one that tells you that those who are voting for the representatives, they do not have what's the best word for it? I'm absolutely at a loss here. They do not have the testinal fortitude. There we go. They don't have the testinal fortitude to actually stand up and say, stop giving me money. Are you kidding me? It's almost like the beggar. There are people that are so dependent on the public purse that they have no will. They've lost their will, and they basically become shills for the government. And that's how we have been basically duped. That's how we've been perverted and subverted. Dr. Franklin now, Benjamin Franklin, steps up and he says, it is of great consequence that we should not depress the virtue and spirit of our common people, of which they displayed a great deal during the war, and which contributed principally to the favorable issue of it. He related the honorable refusal of the American seamen who were carried in great numbers into the British prisons during the war to redeem themselves from misery or to seek their fortunes by entering on board of the ships of the enemy to their country, contrasting their patriotism with contemporary instance in which the British seamen made prisoners of the Americans, readily entered on the ships of the latter on being promised a share of the prize that they might be made out of their own of this country. This proceeded, he said, from the different manner in which the common people were treated in America and Great Britain. He did not think that the elected had any right in any case to narrow the privilege of the voters or the electors. He quoted as arbitrary the British statute setting forth the danger of tumultuous meetings, and under the pretext narrowing the right of suffrage to persons having freeholds of certain value, observing that this statute was soon followed by another under the succeeding parliament, subjecting the people who had no votes to particular labors and hardships. He was persuaded also that such a restriction as was proposed would give great uneasiness to the populace of the states, the son of the substantial farmer not being given themselves freeholders would not be pleased at the disfranchised, and there might be great and there are a great many persons of this description. Now, when we talk, and when I stated that our government doesn't have the ability to actually create these handouts, but we have to get the parties to holding them accountable. But here's the problem. The parties themselves were the first recipients of the handouts. when the federal government decides to do something unconstitutional, the first thing it does is it comes to the state and says, we're going to give you this money, and we want you to do these things. And, oh, by the way, if you do this, you can create your own little cabal of corruption in your state to control these things and these people and so forth. That's how it was done. And the states chose not to hold them accountable because they were actually getting tangible money. Here's the interesting thing I know about money. When money comes off the press, the first people that get their hands on it have the greatest value of that money. And what I mean by that is as money starts to inflate in currency, when government prints more money, the people that get their hands on it, because that money's not in circulation yet. That money, the longer that money gets out into circulation, the less its value becomes. In other words, the inflation takes time. You know, even though the federal government could print a zillion dollars, you know, this trillions and trillions of dollars, and have it stuck in a treasury, that doesn't mean our currency has been inflated. Inflation occurs when the money in circulation increases, because all of a sudden now there's more and more money and people want more of that money for their goods and services and so forth. So those who are those people that introduce the money into the populace, they get the fullest value of that money at that point in time based on the currency. It is, and who are those people? It's the bankers. And so this is this incestuous relationship that our government has created regarding our financial system, where the bankers absolutely get the greatest advantage, and then they charge interest. Anyway, excuse me. So as we move down and we go further down, and this is actually Wednesday, August 8th, this is also a property comment, and this is by Mr. Governor Morris again, and he moved to insert, quote, free, close quote, before the word inhabitants. Much, he said, would depend on this point. He never would concur in upholding domestic slavery. It was a nefarious institution. It was the curse of heaven on the states where it prevailed. Compare free religions, excuse me, compare free religions in the regions of the Middle States where a rich and noble cultivation marks the prosperity of happiness of the people, with the misery and poverty which overspread the barren wastes of Virginia, Maryland, and the other states having slaves. Travel through the whole continent, and you will behold the prospect continually varying with the appearance and disappearance of slavery. The moment you leave these eastern states and enter into New York, the effects of the institution become visible. Passing through the Jersey and entering into Pennsylvania, every criterion of superior improvement witnesses the change. Proceed south with every step you take through the great region of slaves presents a desert increasing with the increase of population of these wretched beings. Now, this actually should probably have stated the wretched practice, this wretched principle. Upon what principle is it that the slaves shall be computed in representation? Are they men? Then make them citizens and let them vote. Are they property? Then there is no other property included. The houses in the city of Philadelphia are worth more than the wretched slaves which cover the rice swamps of South Carolina. The admission of slaves into representation, when fairly explained, comes to this: that the inhabitants of Georgia and South Carolina, who goes to the coast of Africa and in defiance of the most sacred laws of humanity, tears away his fellow creatures from their dearest connections and damns them to the most cruel bondages shall have more votes in government instituted for protection of the rights of mankind than the citizens of Pennsylvania or New Jersey who view this laudable horror as a nefarious practice. Now, in all fairness, one of the things that he's kind of commenting on that I think that he, you know, I need to kind of clarify is this idea that these slaves are wretched. The slavery is wretched. I don't think it is, because he talks about the most sacred laws of humanity tears away his fellow creatures. Now, the other thing is, these states, North Carolina, Georgia, they didn't have their own slave trade where they sent militants into Africa to actually do what he's talking about. The institutions that were doing this was the Islamic State, the Ottoman Empire, who was working with the Portuguese and the Spaniards. Why? Because the Ottoman Empire was the biggest recipient of slavery. Excuse me. Sorry, I've been fighting a frog for the past week. And actually, I'm going to be continually fighting this frog as I ebb and flow from my health treatments and so forth. Anyway, let me move on to what Mr. Morris has said. He would add that domestic slavery is the most prominent feature in the aristocratic countenance of the proposed Constitution. The vassalage of the poor has ever been the favorite offspring of aristocracy. And what is the proposed compensation to the northern states for a sacrifice of every principle of right and every impulse of humanity? They are to bind themselves to march their militia for the defense of the southern states, for their defense against those slaves whom they complain. They must supply vessels and seamen in case of foreign attack. The legislature will have indefinite power to tax them by excises and duties on imposts, both of which will fall heavier on them than on the southern inhabitants, for the booty used by a northern freeman will pay more tax on the whole consumption of the miserable slaves, which consists of nothing more than his physical subsistence and the rag that covers his nakedness. On the other side, the southern states are not to be restrained from importing fresh supplies of wretched Africans at which to increase the danger of attack and the difficulty of defense. Nay, they are to be encouraged to it by an assurance of having their votes in the national government increased in proportion, and they are the same to have their exports of slaves exempt from contributions for the public service. Let it not be said that direct taxation is to be proportioned to representation. It is idle to suppose that the general government can stretch its hand directly into the pockets of the people scattered so vastly so vast a country. They can only do it through the medium of exports, imports, and excises. For what then are all these sacrifices to be made? He would sooner submit himself to a tax for paying for all the Negroes in the United States than saddle prosperity with a constitution. Very strong words, very strong words. But you can tell they're really talking and they're really pointing out what an unholy burden these three states, the Carolinas and Georgia, are placing upon the Union. So it starts, and so it truly starts here on, what day is this? This is August 8th, where he actually draws this line. And I loved how he started it off, to insert free before the words inhabitants. And this is where he actually starts talking about, you know, this unholy institution of slavery. Now, the next few comments, we've got about 4 minutes, so I'll fly through the next few comments. This is New Jersey, Mr. Dayton, seconded the motion. He did it, he said, that his sentiments on the subject might appear whatever might be the fate of the amendment. Mr. Sherman of Connecticut did not regard the admission of Negroes into the ratio of representation as liable to such insuperable objections. It was the freemen of the southern states who were, in fact, to be represented according to the taxes paid by them, and the Negroes are only included in the estimate of the taxes. This was the idea of the matter. Mr. Pinckney of South Carolina considered the fisheries, now they're going to, at the throats of the New Englanders, and he says, consider the fisheries and the western frontier as more burdensome to the United States than the slaves. So in other words, he's defending himself, or defending this institution, and he thought this could be demonstrated if the occasion were a proper one. Mr. Wilson of Pennsylvania thought that the motion premature. An agreement to the clause would be no bar to the object of it. On the question, motion to insert free before inhabitants, New Hampshire, no. Massachusetts, no. Connecticut, no. New Jersey, aye. Pennsylvania, no. Delaware, no. Maryland, no. Virginia, no. North Carolina, so the only state that said yes was New Jersey. So they removed, they didn't include free before inhabitants. On the suggestion of Mr. Dickinson, the words, quote, provided that each state shall have one representative at least, were added without any contest. Article 4, Section 4 was amended and was agreed without contest, and the same thing with Article 5 being taken up, and they got into Article 5, but that's for you to read and for you to find out. So the next thing that we think, that I believe is really important, and we needed to, I wanted to highlight this, was what Mr. Butler basically said on foreign/immigrants. And Mr. Butler said foreign/immigrants was decidedly opposed to the administration of foreigners without long residence in the country. They bring with them not the attachments to other countries, but ideas of government so distinct from ours that in every different point of view are dangerous. He acknowledged that if he himself had been called into public life within a short time after coming to America, his foreign habits, opinions, and attachments would have rendered him an improper agent in public affairs. He mentioned the great strictness observed in Great Britain on this subject. Folks, how many people do you know complain when they see Californians move into their states? Why is it that we allow them immediate suffrage when they come in? Is it not reasonable? Now, it's one thing for them to be able to vote in the federal elections, but should they be able to vote in the state elections to constrain people from being able to engage in the local representation in government, at least for a while, so that they can understand the changes between one government and the next? Because what ends up happening, because this is exactly what everybody, any state that is close to California, and I'm probably going to say the same thing with New York, any of these liberal bastions, when you see more and more cars with those license plates show up in your state, all of a sudden your politics starts turning around and going in the wrong direction, where they're starting to implement the policies that actually destroyed the states that they left. Anyway, something to chew on. I thought that this one thought was worth giving to you, so there you go. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution?
To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.